Hello, and welcome to Tantramar Report on CHMA 106.9 FM. We're broadcasting from Sackville, New Brunswick, the heart of the Maritimes, on the traditional and unceded lands of the Mi'kmaq people. I'm Erica Butler. It's Wednesday, November 3rd. Coming up on today's show, we chat with Memram Cook Tantramar MLA Megan Mitten about the first day back in the legislature yesterday and what she thinks is needed to end the CUPE strike. And we hear from Rachel Henikowski, a Mann Allison student who has been looking for affordable and accessible housing since June. That's coming up after these news and information updates. Public Health reported 40 new cases of COVID-19 on Tuesday, with 14 of those cases in Zone 1. 10 of the new cases in Zone 1 are under investigation, and 4 are known contacts of previous cases. Testing numbers in the province have dropped since the strike by CUPE hospital workers began. Just 408 tests were completed in the province on Monday, with 104 of them in Zone 1. The province says that lab testing is being limited to 4 priority groups, including people who are symptomatic, those working in vulnerable settings such as shelters or long-term care homes, those requiring a test for travel, and those prioritized by a medical officer of health. The province is continuing to distribute rapid test kits to people who are not symptomatic, but the Sackville location and other mobile distribution sites are on hold for now. The Moncton distribution site on McNaughton Avenue is still open Monday to Friday from 1 p.m. to 6 p.m. CUPE continues its strike today, with picketers in Sackville gathering again at York and Main. On Friday, we'll bring you more voices from the picket lines. On Tuesday, MLAs were back in Fredericton to reconvene the provincial legislature for another session. I called up Memram Cook Tantramar MLA Megan Mitten on Tuesday afternoon to find out how the first day went and what she's hoping Higgs will do to end the CUPE strike and what else is on her agenda for the next 2 months. So you were back in the legislature today, and I gather there was no back-to-work legislation introduced. Were you expecting it today, or are you still expecting it at some point?
I wasn't expecting back-to-work legislation today. The premier had said it wouldn't be today, but they got rid of the throne speech to make it more flexible so that they could bring it forward. So I think it still could happen, but what needs to happen, according to, well, in my opinion, and you know, CUPE workers, is that the premier needs to go back to the negotiating table. There are people across the province who are experiencing everything from an inconvenience to hardship because of the worker action that he has forced. And so we're calling on the premier to go back to the negotiating table and to put aside the pension issue for a later date. That's not urgent. They're pretty close on wages, and he can choose to go back to the table and end this strike.
Now, in terms of the Greens have been asking for an emergency debate. Do you think that that is going to happen?
It's unclear at this time. We asked for an emergency debate today, and the procedure for that is that the Speaker rules on it pretty quickly, and his ruling was essentially maybe later. And so we're going to keep pushing for an emergency debate and to call on the premier to go back to the table and to negotiate in good faith and ensure that workers have fair contracts. So we will see. I think at this point, a lot of things are unpredictable.
Have you been speaking to CUPE picketers in Sackville before you headed to Fredericton?
Yeah. Since the action started, I've gone to speak with members on the picket lines, and I stopped on Monday on my way to Fredericton to let them know that, you know, I'd be going to Fredericton to fight for them. And, you know, some of the workers have been saying, you know, I don't really want to be here, but we've got to do what we've got to do. They've been without contracts for years. They haven't seen a real wage increase in years. And enough's enough, essentially. And I've been hearing from constituents as well, overwhelmingly supportive of the workers and calling on Higgs to you know, end the strike, go back to the table and work things out.
There was a march to the legislature today on Tuesday in Fredericton. Did you see crowds there?
Indeed, I did. So I went to check it out a while before the legislature started sitting, and there were already, I'd say, hundreds of people in front of the legislature, and then hundreds more arrived. It was the biggest demonstration that I've seen at the legislature in my few years here. And people were just calling for the Higgs government to give them a fair contract. It was a pretty impressive show of solidarity from CUPE workers. And, you know, I talked to a few of them who were, you know, educational assistants and school bus drivers and, you know, hardworking people that were here to call on the government to sign fair contracts for them.
Now, in addition to the resolution of this contract dispute and the strike, what else is on your agenda, at least for this legislative session? Which I guess is not really, yeah. I mean, it's sort of a continued session. But anyway, what, like this season, let's call it.
Sure. Yeah. Well, for the fall. Without the throne speech, which we don't know when that will happen. We don't have a legislative calendar, so we don't know exactly what's going to happen over the next 2 months. But some of the key issues that I'm going to be working on and focusing on are healthcare. We've been waiting for the 5-year plan to be presented from Minister Shepherd. And I know that everyone in the community is really wondering what's going to be in there and how it will impact, you know, our riding of Memram Cook Tantramar and the Sackville Memorial Hospital. And so specifically, the government needs to do a better job in terms of staffing and fixing the issues with the staff shortages at our hospital to ensure it can be back at full capacity. But on a broader scope, we need to be looking at, does this plan really address some of the rural issues that our riding experiences? And transportation is one of the major issues that we see. And so looking at that, looking at housing, affordable housing is such a major issue. And again, what's the rural plan? What is going to be in place? Because often, you know, healthcare, housing, a lot of things, or transportation, they're looked at through an urban lens. And we need to look at the rural lens. You know, half of New Brunswickers live in rural areas. What's the government doing to make sure that rural people are not neglected as they have historically been? And then I've already tabled some petitions on behalf of constituents for road work, petitioning the Department of Transportation and Infrastructure to do work on roads like 935 and on Lower Rockport Road, to make sure that rural roads are not neglected. So there's a theme here. Rural areas have been neglected, and I'm standing up to say this can't continue. And then climate change. We can't forget that we have the global crisis of the pandemic, and then we have the global crisis of climate change. And COP26, you know, world leaders are meeting in Scotland right now. But we need our government here to take bolder action to mitigate climate change, and transportation, looking at public transportation would be really important. That's a huge part of our emissions, but also adapting. I'm worried about our riding is really vulnerable for flooding. So the Chignecto Isthmus report, where is that? We've been waiting a long time. And people are already being impacted, dealing with heat waves, their wells running dry, farmers dealing with, you know, hay shortages and weird weather in terms of growing crops. There's lots of impacts we're already feeling, and our governments need to do a whole lot more.
That was Memram Cook Tantramar MLA Megan Mitten. One of the issues Megan Mitten says is top of mind for her is housing. And in a recent interview with CHMA, Sackville Mayor Sean Michaud noted the scarcity of rental housing in Sackville, wondering if the growing problem might need to be tackled, or at least studied, by town council. Sackville has seen a considerable in-migration in these recent years, as evidenced by the hot real estate market. There's also been a growth in the Mount A student population, and residences are chock-a-block full. According to the university, Mount Allison's 8 largest residences have almost 100% occupancy right now, and one smaller residence, Carriage House, is being used by faculty or staff members leasing rooms. The university spokesperson Laura Dillman told CHMA that the school felt it needed to provide short-term housing for faculty and staff who have had trouble finding accommodations in the current housing market. But in a market of high demand and low availability, some people fare worse than others. Just ask Rachel Henikowski. The part-time Mount A student and her partner have been looking for new digs since June after about a year of coasting on sublets. Henikowski has double jeopardy when it comes to a housing search. She has cerebral palsy, which requires her to use a walker to get around, which means she needs an apartment where she can avoid stairs and uneven surfaces. She's also low income. Her partner Jack is precariously employed, and she is currently not working due to an ongoing recovery from a concussion sustained during a fall. Rachel and Jack ended up back in Sackville at the beginning of the pandemic. Henikowski thought it would be a good opportunity for her to upgrade the GPA on her Mount A degree in sociology and psychology. And at first, it worked out well. From where she was living in BC, Henikowski was able to secure an affordable sublet on an apartment in an accessible building, one of two that she's identified in Sackville. But this past summer, the sublet expired. Henikowski and her partner took a stab at the full-cost lease, but within a month, the new rent proved to be beyond their means, and they moved out with no place to go. The couple has been couch surfing and living in borrowed accommodations since then. The occasional kind stranger has replied to Henikowski's plea on social media and supplied the couple with temporary digs. But the unreliability has taken its toll and created a catch-22 situation. Late this summer, Jack found some work with enough income to expand the couple's options in the rental market, but the expensive and accessible apartment that they had been renting was no longer available. Out of necessity, they moved temporarily to borrowed accommodations in Dorchester, but that meant Jack could no longer get to work reliably. The couple was in a frustrating chicken-and-egg predicament. They needed income in place so that they could secure housing, but they also needed housing to be able to secure a good income. The stress of the situation is taking its toll on Henikowski, affecting her ability to complete her schoolwork and also her physical condition, which is exacerbated by stress. I sat down with Henikowski last week to hear more about her situation and what she thinks could be done to help it. Let's turn to talk about solutions a bit. I know that you're not really staring at any in the immediate future, but you've been talking to lots of people, looking into lots of different things. You know, if you think about the long term, like what do you think could be in place that would have made this whole experience a bit easier for you and would maybe help you get out of it sooner?
Well, I've been thinking about that from two perspectives. So when I think about it, first I approach it as a student. So what resources would I want to see there as a student for students at Mount Allison who are in this position or at other universities and colleges for that matter? First, I think that the university could take a more proactive approach in realizing that the, you know, food insecurity, housing insecurity are real issues that students face and you kind of need more than an occasional food box that the students can go pick up from, which is, I think, what's in place now. I think that it would require a lot of planning from the university, which they probably don't feel is in their wheelhouse. But student wellness, you know, and an ability of a student to be able to do their work is why they're here. And so I do think it is relevant. I am speaking from my personal experience only, but I do also think that the Students' Union could implement further changes to support students going through these issues. Mm-hmm.
You had mentioned getting help from like the university in terms of student wellness. And that's an area that I think universities have been growing their services in probably for the past few decades. Mm-hmm. What do you think they should add to their roster?
I think that someone who acts as a social worker for these types of issues, not not just in terms of mental health, but in terms of, okay, here's a student facing a crisis to do with housing, to do with food, to do with other life necessity type security situations or personal safety. I think that if there was like resources that were sort of even put into a booklet, you know, or you could sit down and discuss it, and it would be, they would already have something to present to you so that they weren't scrambling to come up with something. Mm-hmm. I think that in order to have something to present to students in those situations, the university would need to hire a person to fill that specific position.
Mm-hmm. Now, the other side of that, of course, is that, you know, when a social worker is referring you to services, that there needs to be some services to be referred to.
Yes.
Your experience, you mentioned your experience in BC as generally positive. In New Brunswick, it hasn't been so easy. What do you see as sort of, you know, what could the province be doing differently to make these crisis situations, I guess, less frequent and make them go by quicker for people?
I did have a more positive experience in British Columbia coping with all these types of issues. I think that comes down to two things. I think that it comes down to the type of government that's in power in whatever province, and I think it comes down to what priorities that government has. You know, I think the argument when I have this discussion with a lot of people, the answer that I get, well, New Brunswick is so small, they just don't have the money. The government just doesn't have the money. And I'm not a politician, so I recognize that I'm not an expert in replying to that line of argument. But what I would say from my own studies in sociology and social work and from my own personal experience is there's always money to be found, and it's just a matter of what governments prioritize. And so if the New Brunswick government wanted to expand their social services program, I'm quite certain they could do that. And I think that's what it would take.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In terms of like assistance, and assistance rates are quite low here, and so
yes,
and you were saying as you as a student, you actually can't access that funding anyway.
Yes, I actually just found that out today, and I found out when I had applied for social assistance years ago when I was a student here. They told me that the issue was that I had active student loans that I was living off of. Like, I remember years ago sitting in the social assistance office, and I was about to leave residence, and because of some family issues, I had to go to a shelter for a time. And they said to me, you know, we can't give you anything other than a comfort allowance of $30 while you're in the shelter, and when you go back to school in September, we can't give you anything. So maybe you should think of not going to school. Right? And so they were trying to tell me that I needed to stop my education, mm-hmm. if I wanted to get the support that I needed, right. When I had no other way of getting that support. And that seems to be what is echoing once again. Mm-hmm. And I think that we should be supporting people to get whatever kind of education they want, and also recognizing that student loans are limited, right? So not all student loan programs give you enough money to live on, and most of them don't. A lot of them will just pay for your tuition. And so I don't know why it would be expected otherwise. And also, not everyone is eligible through their bank for student lines of credit. Often you'll need someone to co-sign for you, and people might not have that. So I don't think those barriers are taken into account either.
Mm-hmm. I would talk about one more area of like solutions. The housing supply, like in Sackville, you mentioned mm-hmm. that there's just really a couple buildings where you don't think you'd have any access issues getting in and out and doing that. How much do you consider the problem with, you know, your particular housing situation being that there just aren't that many apartments available that are up to a standard of accessibility?
Yes, having more accessible housing available would absolutely make it easier.
Because there have been houses you've looked at or apartments you've looked at, but they haven't been suitable due to accessibility, right?
Yes, I've looked at 3 different apartments and 1 house, and those were difficult to find. Those were needles in a haystack, calling the whole list of landlords provided by the MassU office and Student Life, calling all of them back 3 or 4 times just to secure being able to look at those. And that just, I think the overall housing crisis is one thing, and then you add in the accessibility component. And I think one point that's important to make is it's not just people with permanent disabilities that are going to have trouble with accessibility. You know, whether you're aging or whether you have an injury that is just sporadic, something like that, that could cause you, you know, one day you can climb up your flight of stairs to get into your apartment building, and then maybe you have an injury and you can no longer do that. So those are things to take into account, that it's not just the minority of people who have a continual permanent disability. But in my case, like, from what I've seen, there's 2 buildings in Sackville that have elevators, 2 apartment buildings. And having an elevator is huge when you have difficulty with stairs. And so just increasing that number would certainly help. I think the reason that isn't done is because, like most small towns, especially in the Maritimes, it's a lot of older homes and older buildings that are purchased by new landlords, and they're just rented out in their condition. And they know that because the majority of people are A, desperate for housing, and B, most people are able-bodied, well, then they don't need to look at the accessibility component. Mm-hmm. But if they did, it would make a huge difference, and it would make it more accessible for everyone.
Now, you've reached out publicly about this situation because you need some help finding housing, and that has helped you out a bit with some temporary situations, right? So it's got you through, but you're looking at an impending crisis right now, right? I mean, you're in crisis, but it's about to get worse. Was it difficult to reach out publicly and to speak publicly about that?
Yeah. I think for anyone it would be difficult, because homelessness is an incredibly difficult issue. And I think people I've known that have faced housing insecurity, or they continually have to live with their family because they can't afford to be on their own, or that sort of thing, people just don't feel that they can talk about it. They don't know how they're going to be received. And I mean, I study sociology, so from a systemic perspective, unfortunately, the stigma that's around homelessness actually exacerbates the problem. You know, I strongly feel that if we were to talk about highly stigmatized issues like homelessness and mental illness and suicide and all these societal psychosocial problems more often, and have honest, genuine discussions about them, that people would feel less shame and they'd be able to work through them. But for me personally, even knowing all of that and believing that within myself and having that conviction, it's still very difficult for me to talk about. It's not something that you want to share. It's something that you want to call a few close family members and maybe your best friends and ask them for help. So for me, when it got to a point where I did that and I wasn't able to secure anything in that way, it just got to a point where I thought, you know what, social media can be used as a really good tool as well, and I don't think I have anything to lose, and maybe I can help more than just myself. Maybe I can help bring awareness to the issue, and maybe somebody else who's experiencing this will hear this, and maybe they'll feel open to talk about what they go through. And so I was also trying to make something positive come out of it, as well as trying to scramble and help myself out.
Yeah. So what are your next steps going to be, Rachel? What do you think you're going to, you know, I mean, you've knocked on a lot of doors, and you've spoken to government departments, your MLA, student union, wellness center here at the university. What do you think is your next move?
Well, moving forward, I'm going to try to just keep my head above water and keep looking for somewhere to live in Sackville, particularly because driving has become more difficult for me. I'm also planning on working with Ability New Brunswick, a nonprofit organization in New Brunswick that helps people with mobility disabilities, who I think you've spoken to. They've agreed to work with me, and they can even send someone to come talk to me about what my goals would be. I'm also going to be hopefully working with CCRW in Moncton, which helps people with disabilities connect to different work opportunities. So once I get settled in housing, I plan to do that. But if I don't find any housing here in Sackville, I am also looking at across the border in Amherst, which opens up a whole set of other opportunities because it's a different province. So the social assistance and social services are different and better. In fact, they're a lot better. If the driving wasn't an issue, then that's probably what I would do. It would be a wiser decision. So now I have to kind of weigh both options, because I do have apartments I'm going to be looking at here, one in Sackville and two in Amherst. So now I have to try and weigh all the pros and cons and do it in a, with a concerted, wise effort that is beyond my capacity at the moment, but I need to try and get there anyway, like for the betterment of myself. And I'm also working with a local OT, like occupational therapist, who reached out to me personally, just to try to figure out ways that no matter what space I'm in, I can make it more accessible, you know, for myself. Right. And so I'm going to do that. And I'm going to try and support, you know, my partner in getting the work opportunities that he wants to do. You know, and he's a photographer, and that's really important to him. So we're looking at ways and how he can expand that, but again, need some stability first. Mm-hmm. So just gonna try all the avenues possible. Just keep trying.
Thanks so much for sharing your story with us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
That was Rachel Hanikowski, a Mount Allison student currently looking for an accessible apartment in Sackville. Situations like that of Hanikowski and her partner are not all that in common in New Brunswick. Haley Flaro is the director of Ability NB.
There is an affordable, accessible housing crisis in New Brunswick right now. We have more people than ever that, are living with mobility devices, with a mobility disability, that are living underhoused or on the streets, or, I'd like to say in shelters or transition homes, but we have very few accessible ones in the province, so our population gets quite marginalized.
Fully accessible housing does not cost more to build, according to Flaro. There are even subsidy programs designed for homeowners and landlords to retrofit spaces for accessibility, as long as those living in the spaces are low income. The trouble is, those programs can take a long time, and the budget envelopes for them often get spent while there is still demand.
I will tell you that for housing modifications, if someone is applying to the province of New Brunswick, the process is quite slow and long. We have a lot of people that get stuck in hospitals, get stuck in very precarious situations because by the time that they screen in, by the time that they have their financial eligibility assessed, by the time they get an occupational therapist to make their recommendations, by the time they get quotes, by the time the inspector from MB Housing can take a look at it, it can be many, many months. And often MB Housing programs run out of funding way before the end of the year. So we're getting to the point where some regions are very tight in New Brunswick on funding and maybe running out soon, and people will have to wait in line for April 1.
That's Haley Flaro, director of Ability NB. The Department of Social Development reports that in the last fiscal year, 111 households, mostly low-income homeowners, received an average of $8,000 each in forgivable loans to make their homes more accessible. Ability NB also works directly with people with mobility challenges to help navigate the possible programs that might in turn help them meet their housing needs. Rachel Hanikowski is working with the organization and will be following her story. If you have a housing issue you'd like to discuss, get in touch with us at news@chmafm.com. That's it for CHMA's Tantramar Report for this Wednesday, November 3rd. I'm Erica Butler. Thanks for listening.